My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true, like ice, like fire.
Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. That's Joan Baez singing about Bob Dylan. And Joan Baez and Bob Dylan were, as many of you know, lovers. So the show begins with that. You will hear Joan Baez singing about Bob Dylan, because near the end of the show, you will hear my colleague and friend Greg Kot, the tireless Tribune rock critic, talking about his new book, not new, but his One Book, One Chicago book about Mavis Staples. And it's a great book, but one of the great highlights in that book is how Bob Dylan was in love with Mavis Staples, and they will be appearing at the Wintrust Arena. I guess maybe, I don't know, Ted Gregory's in here, my friend and a colleague and an incredibly talented reporter and writer. Most reporters at the Tribune do not get to display their writing skills at long narrative length, because we don't write long narrative stories mostly for the Tribune. Ted has a new book out. It's called Mary Jane's Ghost, The Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America, and it is terrific. Doesn't do it. You'll hear a number of adjectives throughout the whole thing. So, Ted, don't be embarrassed. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
This is a book. One of the reasons I really liked it, it focuses on a long-ago double murder in downstate Illinois, but it also is about newspapers. It also, it's very honestly about you, too. It is also about ghosts and obsession.
Right.
And how do we start? You get in the mail.
Yeah.
A letter on Lavender Stationery. That's basically, it's how the book starts,
right,
too.
Right, right. And so it starts really in 2003. I'm a general assignment reporter at the Tribune, kind of marooned in the suburbs when all the action is downtown.
Oh, you think all the action.
Right, downtown. And this letter arrives. Actually, it's a packed envelope of stuff arrives sort of mysteriously on my desk. I'm still not sure exactly why it wound up there, but it does. And inside is a letter. And the letter talks about an unsolved double murder, as you said, on a lover's lane late on a summer night in 1948 in scenic Oregon, Illinois, in the beautiful Rock River Valley. Mm-hmm. If you head straight north here from the studio, you go to North Avenue, you turn left and go for 100 miles, that's where Oregon, Illinois is.
So, and it is the way you describe it. It's a beautiful small town. It is evocative of, you know, the great days of small town America.
Yeah, I really think it was. And that's one of the things that sort of kept me going in the book, sort of kept me into the case, was the place kept drawing me to it. It has a very rich and kind of wild history. But this murder occurs in 1948. It's late at night. 17-year-old. Local telephone operator Mary Jane Reed and 28-year-old
Stanley
Scridla from Rockford are in an embrace.
Oh, at Lover's Lane.
Right. Someone attacks them. Stanley either is pulled from the car or gets out of the vehicle, is shot several times. Mary Jane is abducted. Her body isn't found for 4 days. There's a massive manhunt, front page coverage from
this story was. It was not just fodder for Chicago newspapers. This was a nationwide story,
right? From Portland, Maine to Long Beach, California, and a lot of coverage. And I think folks can understand why. I mean, it was very shocking for this to happen. The Tribune sent people out there for days. There was a massive manhunt. After all this manhunt, no one's arrested. Of course, no one's charged. And it just sort of disappears into time's indifference.
Yeah.
Fast forward 50 years later, this kind of eccentric entrepreneur, Mike Arians.
Did you sense that from immediately, Ted Gregory, when you got the package that contained the Lavender stationery? Did you... You get, I mean, because a lot of strange things come to newspapers,
right.
And a lot of strange things come to reporters.
Right.
And most reporters, sadly, dump them. You know what I mean? Or they'll give them a very cursory look.
Right.
Why did you not?
Well, you know, I think just the sort of basic facts of the case it really intrigued me. You know, you've got this big-time case that was covered quite extensively all the way back. This was now 55 or so years ago.
Unsolved.
Unsolved, exactly. Mm. Unsolved. And then you've got this fellow who was he was an insurance fraud investigator and a dinner theater producer, and he moves to town, opens a roadhouse, becomes elected mayor
right,
of Oregon,
right.
And then becomes obsessed with this crime and reaches out to the Chicago Tribune for help.
What, do you have any idea? You got to know this guy,
yeah,
Mike Arians,
yeah,
pretty well.
Mike Arians, right.
Do you have any idea why you had he seen a story of yours that somehow appealed to him where he thought,
no,
well, here's a kindred spirit of some kind?
You know, Mike, in the book I refer to him a little bit, he's a little bit like an amateur boxer, you know. And I think he was doing everything and anything he could to try to get some attention, get
yeah.
some help, get some exposure for the case. He sent it blindly to the Chicago Tribune. He sent this letter. And like I said, it just kind of dropped onto my desk. And as soon as I opened it, it was filled with old newspaper clippings. I love old newspaper
yeah.
clippings.
Had you been to Oregon before?
No, had not. Had never been out there. So he reaches out to the Tribune for help, for exposure. And what I come to find out is he has a very scandalous theory on this case. And he also believes that his roadhouse is inhabited by the ghost of Mary Jane Reed.
See, that's the thing that I think would have caused most, if not all, other reporters to say, well, okay, Mr. Arians, yes, you're visited by a ghost. You write in the book, and again, the title of the book is Mary Jane's Ghost, The Legacy of a Small Town. A Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America by Ted Gregory. My guess is the University of Iowa Press. Handsomely done, I must add. It's a really fabulous,
yeah,
fabulous
thanks. They did a great cover. Job with the cover, right? Yeah.
Before we take a break here, Ted's going to be here for the whole hour, and we'll tell you where his upcoming signings are coming, why he loves being a newspaper man and a dad. But he writes early on in the book, just apropos of talking about this man who saw ghosts. Ted writes, now, let me just say here that when people talk about spirits inhabiting a home or a jail or a dormitory or a roadhouse on the outskirts of a small Midwestern town, I have three fairly distinct responses. One, this person is nuts. Two, this is BS, and this person is trying to play me. Three, I am scared witless. When Mike told me the place was haunted, my reaction was somewhere between numbers two and three. We'll talk more with Ted Gregory after a short commercial break.
You must leave now. Take what you need.
Joan Baez singing the songs written by her one-time lover, Bob Dylan. Bob was earlier in love with Mavis Staples. I'll tell you about that later in the show. Now we're concentrating on Ted Gregory's book. Not his first book, but his first solo book. Mary Jane's Ghost, The Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America. University of Iowa Press has done a magnificent job publishing this. We were just talking about Mike Arians, who got in touch with Ted and sort of told him about this double murder in 1948 on a lover's lane. Well, part of it on a lover's lane. The guy was killed on the lover's lane. The woman was obviously kidnapped, Mary Jane. And that how this Mike guy, who had become mayor of Oregon, who had a roadhouse, ran a bar, restaurant in this, he was firmly convinced that Mary Jane's ghost was visiting him, and you give some great examples. Some occurrences, you write, were more unnerving. The jukebox would spontaneously play the same song after Sunrise by Sergio Mendes in Brazil 77, a guitar melody dominated by the haunting voice of a woman. While Mike was away from the Roadhouse, a delivery man showed up with flowers on November 15th, Mary Jane's birthday, and was turned away, and Mike never did find out who sent them. You, leaving your skepticism in the door, you started to get pretty intrigued, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And for a lot of reasons, you know, I initially went into this thing, as you pointed out, with those three sort of fairly distinct thoughts about people who tell me that that they believe in ghosts. But, you know, one of the things I did before I went out there was called Mike to determine whether or not he was a nut.
Nut, yeah, sure.
Which is what, you know, you
which is what
sure
half
do.
The people who call us are. Right. Yeah.
And you know, when we had a very long phone conversation, and he was clearly not nuts. I mean, he was a very articulate, very sort of, I wouldn't call it almost passive, mm-hmm. You know, not going on and on, would talk about any element of the case that I wanted to talk about for as long as I wanted to talk about it. So I went out there, but he was very initially, and still is, I think, to a certain extent, reluctant to discuss, you know, this the presence of spirits, ghosts, or whatever,
supernatural.
In his Roadhouse, because I think he realizes that it makes him look like a nut.
Yeah, he does, and you quote him as saying, though, that I think this may have been one of the first times you got in touch with him. You talked to a psychic and blah blah blah
right.
blah. You're right. He took a pull from a new cigarette, blew a stream of smoke upward again, looked a little distance. And this is Mike talking. There's a presence at the Roadhouse that is very determined. I almost feel like, as crazy as this sounds, that Mary Jane and I have a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Not. He's very specific to say not a romantic relationship, because if he had said we have a romantic relationship, that's when you would drive away. I have to think that. But he does. I mean, that's one of the incredibly interesting elements of it, too, is this man's obsession.
Yeah.
And you do a great job digging, trying to psychologically digging to try to get at
thanks, Rick.
Well,
that's nice of you to
what
say.
His obsession is. What is his obsession? But, you know, you share, I'm not saying you were obsessed with the story.
Right.
A deep interest is what you had in this.
Yeah, yeah. And I like to, you know, poke fun at it. You know, I wasn't obsessed. No, absolutely not. But I couldn't get it off my mind.
I know.
So I'm not sure what that qualifies as. But there's a part in the book in chapter six where, and maybe I'll read it, where I talk about what was particularly interesting to me about him and what I felt was sort of motivating him. And I think it came from a number of different places. And I think it also was a little bit unclear to him what was sort of driving
him. One of the things that obsesses mankind is the unexplained.
Yeah.
I mean, that is something that drives people, you know, to explore, to dig.
Right. Right.
You want to read something? By all
sure.
means. Ted has a number of events coming up, and we'll tell you where they are, where he will, you know, sell the book, but also read from the book and sit and talk to you nice people who want to come meet him.
Yeah,
and he's
love
a lovely man. He's a lovely man. But now you can hear him read, and this is some of what you'll get at some of his upcoming events.
So this is about essentially why this case hung with me for years and years, for 13 years, really. I knew that the reason the case stayed with me started with the lure of an unsolved double murder, which might draw anyone. But humans have provided plenty of murder mysteries. I was a little surprised to learn that crime analysts estimate that about one-third of homicides, or nearly 185,000 of them, between 1989 and 2008, remain unsolved. What kept this particular case on a constant loop through my mind was a combination of things. Apart from the obvious sympathy generated by the murders of two innocent people, the facts specific to the Reed Scridley killings had the shocking, sad components that would create widespread interest. The ambush of a young, attractive couple, probably in a passionate, perhaps carnal embrace, late on a summer night on a lover's lane. Mary Jane's 4-day disappearance. the frenzied investigation and prominent coverage from my own newspaper and others from coast to coast, whispers of a cover-up. Mike's personal backstory and his obsession with the case were also intriguing. During the 17 years he worked on it, his devotion to Warren Reed, and Warren Reed is Mary Jane's lone surviving sibling, Warren Reed deepened, which, yes, was a little peculiar to me, but noble too. It gave Warren his only hope that his sister's murder would be resolved. I couldn't help admiring Mike's sensitivity when he would talk about the injustice of failing to solve the murder of a local girl from the wrong side of the river. And when Mike would talk about the cracking the conspiracy, I found that courageous. It was David versus Goliath. Also, I was convinced something more motivated him. This business about ghosts and his relationship with Mary Jane, such as it was. He wouldn't come right out and say he was in love with Mary Jane or her ghost, and he understood that sharing anything about the relationship made him look crazy, which he wasn't. But he did let it slip once that he'd arranged to be buried next to her, a move that Warren's children later overturned, and Mike had gotten comfortable with her presence in his life. Watching him struggle to reconcile all that he was feeling with the conventions of normalcy was compelling and a little sad, like watching someone with a burning secret that, if shared, would lead to his ruin. He was like some tragic character in a Shakespeare play. As uncomfortable as it may be to admit, I was drawn to that too. I wanted to keep track of how he was or wasn't managing his demons. The setting had something to do with my interest as well. Oregon felt like this beautiful, largely undiscovered place with its own captivating history. Oregon essentially kept drawing me to it. But I had my distractions, many distractions in the form of other stories that needed telling urgently and often, as is the case in the news business, and which left no time for all those bigger questions in the Mary Jane Reed Stanley Scridla case, or questions about Mike or about Oregon. Every few months or years, when Mike's quest reached a turning point and I could persuade my editors, I'd parachute into Oregon, like I did for all my stories in other places, then move on. Many times, even when those other stories were engaging or consuming, I'd find my mind linking some element of them back, tenuously or directly, to Oregon, Mary Jane, Mike, and the entire case. What was happening was not obsession, I kept telling myself. Absolutely not. I'm not the obsessive type, I said, sometimes aloud, even when I was alone, just for emphasis. These were mere similarities that any logical mind would connect. It was synchronicity, completely rational. Like when I heard about the rebirth of Heinous Abe, the little-known world's tallest, creepiest fiberglass statue of our martyred 16th president standing in a remote patch of the state. What I thought about was this: Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson Davis, two men who later would stand on opposite sides in one of America's most defining, bloodiest crucibles, fought together in the Black Hawk War near Oregon in 1832. 172 years later, I found myself 230 miles southeast of that conflict in Ashmore, Illinois, pursuing the story of a most peculiar statue. It was worth the side trip.
That's great reading.
Thanks.
Look
here. Thanks for letting me do that.
Well, look at my book. It's the same thing I was going to read.
Okay.
That's Ted Gregory reading from Mary Jane's Ghost, The Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America, which is about a lot more than this specific case, which is intriguing as all get out, as they might say, somewhere outside of Chicago. That is the focal point of it. It's also about Ted. It's very personal about Ted and his life and about newspapers and this Heinous Abe statue. We'll explore all of that. Ted's going to be here until 10 o'clock, so we'll try to explore every aspect of this. So stay tuned.
Swift rain won't lift, gate won't close, the railings froze.
Joan Baez with her former lover Bob Dylan singing his songs. Me with my colleague Ted Gregory, who's written a magnificent book called Mary Jane's Ghost, The Legacy of a Murder in Small Town America. Yes, it is about a murder in small town America, a fascinating story and about one man's Oh, I am going to call it an obsession. Not Ted Gregory's, but Mike Arians, who is believes that he is being visited by the ghost of Mary Jane, a young woman who was kidnapped and killed off a lover's lane after her lover was shot and killed there. The book is also about, it is not a paean to newspapers. It is not a paean to small town Illinois, but it will, in the same way, if you drive on the interstates and you get off and you travel through some nice, beautiful back road, it's worth your time. He does take excursions. For instance, listen to what he writes. This is not much of it, but here. He goes, General Simon reporters sprinkled through the cubicle farm inside the building where the food chain at the world's greatest newspaper. He writes, I was married, living in the suburbs with three kids under 5 years old, a minivan, and an obese cat. My career path, for reasons of domestic tranquility, personal sanity, and a desire to have a little more control over my life, kept wending around suburbia for the most part. But city or suburb, a reporter occupies an important place in the democratic republic for which we stand. That's beautifully put. It's romantic. One of the backdrops of this book is the changing face of newspapers, not just specifically the Chicago Tribune, but newspapers in general, downsizing. And, you know, where stories like this do not always find as cozy a home as they once did.
Yeah, right. And, you know, I tell people that, you know, if you're looking for the sort of straight line, true crime, procedural, don't buy this book because it's not the book that you want to read, I don't think.
I think that book is in here, though. I really do.
Yeah.
I think it is in here and taking in the same way. You know, look, if you want to get from Chicago to New York, you can take a plane.
Right.
And if you want to get from Chicago to New York, you can drive the interstates. But if you really want an interesting trip from Chicago to New York, you can take the interstate and get off every once in a while.
Right.
See
right.
something else. That's what I think, the way I think about this book.
Well, thanks. I mean, I tell people, and I sort of paraphrase from a person who reviewed the book for me, I tell people that it's one part detective story, part cultural road trip, and part rumination on newspapers and our desire and our need for stories. You know, I talk about that in various parts of the book, but really, when this case would not go away for me, I thought the reason it wouldn't go away for me was that it was a true crime book that needed to be written like a true crime book.
Yeah.
But the more I thought about that, Rick, the more it just didn't feel right for this case and for all that it kind of meant to me. This case represented other things. It was more nuanced. I think it represents our the effort to revisit our pasts and remake our past, and whether that is worth all the heartache that it can cause. I think it represents how elusive truth can be, and you know, like I said earlier, I think it represents you know, our need for stories. And
well, you write here too, Ted. You write on that very topic. That's what makes history and memory risky when we embark on expeditions to look for more. It does make it risky, but it does also make it worthwhile, I think, even if you do not come to the nice, clean end.
Right, right. And, you know, Rick, I would run into this kind of thing when I would go out to Oregon and want to talk to folks who were still around since the crime occurred, and people who weren't around, to just try to get their thoughts on it. And many people didn't want to talk about it, and
they
were somewhat hostile toward me.
Yeah,
and I get it, and I was always deferential to that. But I felt like getting to the story in a sort of a fair, unbiased way, and exploring it, I just felt like it makes us stronger and better people if we can kind of confront these things and absorb them, make them our own, and move through it. And so I did, and not everybody understood that, but that's the way it goes.
What does Mike, the man who wrote you the letter and sent you the initial package, you and he became... You became great friends, but you certainly became close in unusual ways, I think, in intellectual, maybe even emotional ways. This man wound up expending a great deal, I think, of emotional. This whole thing for him took a physical, emotional, and in its way a financial toll on him,
right.
Eventually fighting to get the bodies exhumed.
Right. So, you know, he lost the mayoral election. He lost his mayoral reelection bid in part because of this. The business at the Roadhouse was maybe half of what it had been. You know, certainly he had spent, you know, tens and 20s and 30s and 40s, 50s, thousands of dollars on this case. And then he had spent hours and hundreds of hours of his own time on it. So all of that, again, was sort of compelling to me. And I think that, you know, we talked about it earlier, people try to assign different motivations for why he did what he did. And I think it did come from a number of different places.
I think it's a very complicated, I think it's a very complicated place. I mean, he didn't know his own dad. There are a number
of
things, and I'm no psychologist.
Right. and I felt like, you know, what I liked about Mike was, he was always very open, and throughout the course of my writing these stories, there were plenty of people who were very critical of him,
and I would put
that in the story, and Mike never, ever, you know, complained about that.
Ted Gregory, how many stories did you wind up writing on this topic for the Chicago Tribune?
I want to say 13 over the years. Which was a lot. Some of them were only seven paragraphs.
Yeah, sure.
Some of them were longer.
Yeah.
But again, Mike was always willing to speak with me and never, you know, complained about the coverage I gave him. And some people were just basically calling him nuts.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, you write here that histories, all them stories, if you like, never really end. It's more like they continue to unfold, but we've left them. They've ceased to resonate. You write in here at this point, 13 years from the first piece I'd written on Mary Jane and Stanley's death, I was ready to leave this story, especially after all the paths that led to dead ends, the absence of any concrete leads, and the lack of interest in, even downright antagonism toward, finding answers. And I did leave it, but only for a few weeks. Then I had two dreams on the same night. That section is so... That section, what follows, is worth the price of the book. And any page in here is worth the price of the book.
Thank you.
We got to take a little commercial break. I think we've done a pretty good job of detailing the book. Now we'll talk to Ted Gregory about how he got it published and where you can see him in the coming weeks.
All right.
We'll be right back. Baez sings Bob Dylan. Scott Turow, the best-selling author, had this to say about Ted Gregory's latest book, Mary Jane's Ghost. He says it is a wonderful book, fast-paced and incisive, about two mysterious deaths, that of a young couple in a small Illinois town nearly 70 years ago, and also of American investigative journalism in recent times. I said nice things about Ted's book, and you can read it on the back. I've said some nice things here, too, because I really think it's a terrific book. Dick Babcock, the former editor of Chicago Magazine, calls it a fascinating reinvestigation of an unsolved Lover's Lane double murder. A rural Illinois Black Dahlia case not only brings texture and insight to an intriguing mystery, but serves as a tribute to the pleasures of a threatened occupation, the newspaper reporter. It's gotten rave reviews, and Ted, was it easy to find? The University of Iowa has done a wonderful, wonderful, lovely job of publishing this book. They must have been a joy to work with.
They were. You know, it's funny. I had co-written two books and had decided that the next book I was going to do was going to be Mary Jane's Ghost. And so I was kind of putting notes together and figuring out how I was going to do it. And I had been dispatched to deep southern Illinois, to Heron, Illinois, to do a story on the Heron Massacre, which this shameful massacre of coal miners in a union uprising or a union siege that happened in 1922. And more recently, in 2013, 2014, some folks got together and were starting to exhume these graves of, of these men that were sort of lost and buried
ignored, forgotten.
Right.
Yeah.
So I did a story about that. And the next day I got an email from the acquisitions editor at University of Iowa Press, Catherine Campbell Cox, bless her. And she said, you know, this is a very interesting story. I think it could make a book, and I'd be interested in seeing an outline if you are so inclined. So I was flattered,
You should be, sure.
Yeah, and so I wrote her back, and I said, I'm really flattered, but I got this other.
Yes, stop. I have a better book. Yes, I have another book.
Which, you know, editors love to hear that, right?
She must have, because the other ones are terribly intriguing. It became Mary Jane's Ghost. She was amenable to listening to your other idea.
So I told her I got this other idea for a book in which I would, in fact, include this story of the Heron Massacre and as part of this sort of main narrative on this of this crime. And so she said, well, that sounds kind of intriguing. Why don't you write me up some stuff? So over the next 6 or 8 months, we worked together on an outline. And then in May of 2015, I signed a contract with the University of Iowa Press because it was a wonderful experience working with Catherine. And it's been wonderful working with them ever since. They really have been very deliberate and very thoughtful.
That is one of the talking about the changing nature of the newspaper business, the changing nature of publishing has run a kind of parallel off the tracks kind of thing these days. Just simply to get a book published is a remarkable achievement these days, especially from a university press, too. Part of the work is not over. When you see your words between covers,
that's right.
The marketing and promotion and flogging, so to speak, of a book never ends. But you like that, too. Where you've got upcoming appearances. October 5th, I know you'll be at the bookseller in Lincoln Square.
Right, Lincoln Square.
And what else have you got? So, well, you can go to the University of Iowa.
If you go to the University of Iowa Press, uipress.edu, that should list all of them.
Put in Ted Gregory, Mary Jane's Ghost. That's one of the great advantages of Google and the internet these days. It'll tell you where he's going to be. Do you enjoy that? You read well, and that's a big part of doing these presentations.
Thanks. You know, I had done it with my co-authors before, but I was in much more of a sort of subordinate role. I would just usually introduce them or say a couple of things.
Yeah.
But when you're standing up there alone, it's quite a bit different, it can be very nerve wracking. I had the launch just a few days ago at Anderson's Bookshop
in
Naperville, which
is
a
great bookstore.
It's a cool place. They do wonderful, just wonderful stuff, and I can't believe that they're thriving as much as they are. And so I did a reading there and took questions and answered and then signed books, had a really nice turnout. So I'm getting more comfortable with that.
Yeah.
And so I'll do a similar setup on October 5th, at the
bookseller. The bookseller is a great bookstore because one of the reasons is they sell beer and wine there. It's like a bookstore bar.
Yeah.
Have you done or do you plan to do anything in Oregon?
It's funny you ask that question, Mr. Kogan. So a few weeks ago, I wasn't sure whether the Oregon Public Library had heard that the book was coming out or not. So I sent an email to them saying, just wanted to give you a heads up. This book is coming out. I'm happy with the way it's come out. I think it's done a fair job of handling and respectful job of handling the case. And I also understand that it's a very sensitive topic for you.
Sure.
Just it's out there. If you want me to come out or whatever, I'd be happy to do that. Silence.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pathetic.
I think it's pathetic. It's just, I mean,
if you're out there, look, the thing was a long, well, I can understand because much of it takes place in contemporary times, but the way that Ted Gregory treats with great affection, the town itself
and
the meaning of that town.
Yeah.
And if they're sorry they're a small town, that's their problem. But I think you treat that place with all due respect.
Yeah, I have.
It's not an indictment of the town at all.
I don't think it is. And I think if folks approach it that way, if they keep an open mind reading the book, they'll see that it's not that at all. And matter of fact, I mean, I have a deep affection for the place.
You capture this wonderful sense of innocence, which is one of the reasons that this double murder blasted across the country.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Clutter family in Kansas in cold blood. That's one of the reasons, the shock of a quiet town being disrupted like this.
Right.
Ted, I can't wait for the next book. I don't know if it's going to come from you haven't got any lavender stationery recently, but terrifically, you dedicated to your mom, too.
Yeah.
But you can be real proud because it is a difficult thing to write a book, especially when you are working as a full-time and talented reporter and writer for the Tribune, too. And it's an ongoing pleasure to know you, too, because we've known each other for a long time.
Right.
I've got
some great Rick Hogan stories we can't share here.
Yeah, we can't share that. That's for some podcast. That's for some weird Lise Graham's podcast. It'll be the real Rick Hogan. We'll go in there and do that. Ted, best of luck with the book. And you can go to all you need, Ted Gregory. That's very easy. I'm not going to insult you by spelling it for you. Mary Jane's Ghost. That's very easy, too. Just Google that. Find out where he's appearing. And buy the book. Mary Schmeek, I'll give you this, the last one. Mary Schmeek, our colleague at the Tribune, writes of the book. Mary Jane's Ghost is part detective story, part road trip, and part rumination on the nature of modern newspapers. I loved Ted Gregory's witty, graceful writing, his quest to figure out who killed Mary Jane, and the way he makes us ponder the big mystery. Why do we need stories anyway? We do need stories, Ted, and you write great ones.
Oh, Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, my
much
pleasure.
For
it was so fun to have you
so
on. I've read this
fun.
Book. I've read
thank
this book
you.
Twice, for God's sake. Twice.
That's
twice, I tell you. We'll take a little commercial break, and then we'll get some news, and then Mike Houlihan will be in here to tell you more about the world's only Irish-American film festival.